This is the beginning of tape number one of the final version of the autobiography 1944, the beginning of the invasion, to 1945. Before looking at the events of the invasion of Europe in 1944, it would be as well, perhaps, to recap on the events of the war at large which had led up to it and had put it into the frame, particularly this clamour for what had become known as a second front, which by no means, so far as the British Empire was concerned, was it in any way a second front. It was about the 15th. The Japanese had entered the war at the turn of the year 1941-42 with devastating effect. Singapore had fallen in February 42, and the Japanese went on from strength to strength, unchecked before mid-1942, and beyond, leapfrogging right down to Java, which was to become, in fact, the nub of the resistance to them. They had invaded Burma from Siam in January 1942, and Siam had declared war on Great Britain and the USA on the 25th of January. And the British were pushed right back onto India. But there was better news from the Soviet Union, from Russia. Marshal Zhukov had raised a number of sieges, and he began to turn the tables on the Germans, resulting in a kind of Napoleonic retreat from Moscow by the Germans into 1943. Meanwhile, things were beginning to happen in the Middle East and Southern Europe as well. Montgomery had replaced Auchinleck in command in the Middle East, and he built up strength very cautiously before striking at Alamein. In fact, I always feel that Auchinleck was a very much ill-used general. He was a good man, he was just unlucky. However, when Montgomery struck at Alamein, with results I needn't go into, the Germans started to go westwards in retreat and then found themselves sandwiched between the 8th Army and the 1st Army and the Americans in the North African landings further west. They took a pretty fatal pounding. An army sent under von Arnim to North Africa to reinforce them arrived just in time for complete surrender and impounding, rather like the British and the Anzacs in Singapore. This campaign also marked the first effective appearance of the Free French, and it was their kind of country, Algeria, Morocco, and so on. And the Axis in Tunisia surrendered in May 1943, and the Sicily invasion was soon to follow in June and July. In Sicily, Catania fell on the 5th of August, Messina on the 17th. But there were only 7,000 Germans captured, and most others were escaping to the mainland, delaying possible further invasion. But the total Axis casualties in Sicily were 163,000. It led to the downfall of Mussolini on the 24th of July, and the invasion of the mainland of Italy began in mid-August at Salerno. On the 3rd of September, significant day, there was an armistice with the Italians, and Churchill recognized them then as co-belligerents. He said he wasn't having them as allies, but he didn't mind calling them co-belligerents. That's the limit of his concession. The 8th Army also crossed to Calabria that day and began to advance up the peninsula. The Italian fleet escaped to Malta and Alexandria. The Germans evacuated Sardinia and were thrown out of Corsica, but largely disarmed the Italian army there. At the same time, Tito's Yugoslavs were being strengthened and encouraged with Allied support. In 1943, too, the U-boat campaign began to falter, though there was still a kind of hole in the Middle Atlantic in our defences, which continued to be a problem. Right in the middle of the Atlantic, the naval forces from Europe and from America couldn't quite meet, and there was always an area which was still a bit vulnerable to U-boat activity. However, this was finally closed by aircraft carriers, and the Portuguese, who came out of a bit of a shell, gave permission for use of bases in the Azores. Indeed, about 60 U-boats were destroyed during the period August to October 1943, a number we had not dreamed of destroying ever in the past. The British and American factories began production on a fairly big scale, putting us on a much better term all round, and the Allied bombing in particular of Hamburg helped to exploit this growing inequality between the Allies and the Germans on the production side. And on the 18th of May, the Myrna and Ada dams were burst by the dam busters. Exactly what effect that had in the end, apart from one on morale, has never been quite clear. It's thought that it probably didn't do nearly so much damage to the German economy as we thought at the time. But we were, of course, all the time looking for things to cheer about. The Germans mounted an offensive in Russia in the summer on the Kursk-Orel salient, but they were defeated with huge losses. Orel and Kharkov were recaptured in August 1943, and the Russians then began an offensive along the total line. So by the spring of 1944, we had the situation really that the Allies were pushing slowly and rather bloodily, unfortunately, up through Italy. The Russians were on the offensive all the way along, and therefore the time really was ripe for another blow. And that's where we came in. So our battalion, and no doubt the entire division, moved down from the area of Filey and Hunmanby and Yorkshire in general, down southwards in March or April 1944. We knew something was up, but we didn't know quite what, and of course we didn't know that we were going to Aldershot. We moved down in our trucks and vehicles, and it was my memory that when we got to Aldershot, we were billeted in huts rather than barrack rooms. I can't remember this for certain, but I'm sure that if I'd been in a barrack room, I'd have remembered it. Nevertheless, the huts were, of course, in a barrack area. Life was quite pleasant for us there. After all, not only were we down south again, where most of us lived, but the spring was coming on, and although we knew that we would probably be in something quite grisly quite soon, we all decided that we'd make the best of life while we could, which is what soldiers usually do. After all, there was always a chance that it wouldn't happen. But one of the disadvantages was that so strong was this rumour that the Second Front was about to descend upon us and that we would be part of it, that in their wisdom the High Command decided that none of us should be able to go home. We were to be cocooned in Aldershot and district. Well, when the army tells soldiers not to do something, that is practically a challenge to do it. And the rackets on the railways were endless. Of course, all the stations were stiff with military and civilian police, and if you looked about the right age for military service, then a military policeman or a civilian policeman instead was allowed to come up to you and say that they wanted to see your pass, a leave of absence from your unit. Now, this was true even if you were wearing civilian dress, but if you were in uniform, you were a dead duck. So the main element, so far as the troops were concerned, in this new exercise was to defeat the police, either civilian or military, by finding somewhere where they were not. But there was another element. Since the troops hadn't two brass farthings to rub together, and Southern Railway were old-fashioned enough to expect you to pay to get to wherever you wanted to get, then some means had to be devised for fiddling the railway as well. And everyone had his favourite way of doing this. And my own formula was as follows. Bearing in mind that we were allowed to go two or three stations in either direction from Aldershot legally, I held a period return half for a station further down the line from Aldershot, and when I got out at Aldershot, I was always, quotes, breaking my journey. I also, every time I went to London or to Wimbledon, as I shall explain, I took a single to Ash, which was the next station up the line, all highly legal. I then stayed on the train, changed at Wimbledon for West Croydon. Now, there were no military police in Wimbledon because, of course, if you're a respectable suburban from Wimbledon, you don't do things like this, so I was fairly safe there. No military police at Wimbledon. So I changed onto the West Croydon sort of Emmett railway line, which went from Wimbledon to West Croydon, and if my ticket was needed at West Croydon, which it very often I discovered wasn't, and there was certainly no military police there either, then I simply said, well, I'm paying on from Wimbledon or Merton or Mitcham or wherever it sounded the least likely, in fact. And of course, as I say, Wimbledon and West Croydon were both free of the fuzz. I therefore had devised a system that was both safe and economical. But there came the evening of what I have ever after regarded as the Great Ash Trap. For some reason which only the Almighty will know about, on this particular evening, it so happened that I was legal in every possible respect, except that I didn't have a pass out of the area. However, apparently, Southern Railways had just about had enough. They hadn't managed to make the books balance with the amount of traffic that had been passing through their barriers. So they had enlisted the attention and assistance of the army in order to try and recoup their losses. And on this particular evening, it seems, a lot of the boys had been taking alleged singles to Ash, and or returns to Ash, and then said they were paying on from Ash. Well, on this particular evening, they closed this trap by not allowing anybody on the train at Ash, with the result that fellas came floating down from London on the train, throwing their Ash tickets at the inspector on the barrier, who then handed them over to the military of police, who said nobody got on at Ash this evening. And there was a great platoon of them lined up for the tumbrils. But for some reason, I was lucky that night. I had a completely legal ticket. Heaven knows why. The Almighty must have known what was going on and come to my rescue. Though I think that the fact was I'd worn out my return half ticket and hadn't had time to renew it. So I just had to buy a legal one that day. Anyway, I didn't half feel virtuous. Although Aldershot was quite a long way down the league table of the last places that God made on earth, it did come just ahead of Tidworth, which in turn was ahead of Saudi Arabia and like places. And in any case, Aldershot did have certain advantages that Tidworth didn't have. And one of them was a lovely country house which had been taken over by the YMCA or YWCA or Church Army or some such well-meaning canteen-running organization which had then recruited a number of delightful gels from the Surrey Hants borders who would come along and in the most respectable possible way entertain the troops. And it was very pleasant to go along there on these warm spring evenings to spend the evening in the grounds or in the house of this lovely residence, in the company, of course, of the equally lovely gels. And one of the main attractions out there in the grounds was deck tennis. And this is where I learned to play deck tennis and became quite a dab hand at it, which later in life stood me in great stead on the ocean liners. Aldershot was also much better endowed than Tidworth was for theatres. It had at least two. One of them had a rather respectable name, something like the Embassy, where you saw serious drama. One tended to think of officers only. And the other one was the Hippodrome, or the Pillis. I'm not sure what it was called, but there you got culture on a rather lower plane, vaudeville, circus, etc. Now, I've already referred briefly to Joe Holgate, the Lance Corporal on my particular carrier, who was a very large, red-faced, Cockney bricklayer by trade, about 36, 7 or 8 years old. He must be long since dead because he was all that much older than we were. Anyway, he was an amusing character. He had a tremendous wit and he used to tell us all sorts of things about his peacetime life as a bricklayer and the kind of tricks they used to play on some of their mates when they went to the lavatory. However, Joe came in early one Saturday evening and found me sitting on my bed, thought I looked rather lonely and in need of company. He said to me, "Hello, Gilly, what you doing, mate?" Oh, I said, "Just reading, Joe." And so he said, "Me and the boys are just going down to Pillis. Come in." Well, it seems that quite soon after they'd arrived, Joe and the boys had cottoned on to this Pillis or Hippodrome or whatever it was as a Friday or Saturday evening entertainment. And they used to go down regularly and made friends with the staff there, as usual duly here, and this was a regular thing. Just snooty old me had stood aside from this and hadn't had anything to do with it up to that point. I didn't know about it, and I don't know whether I would have been instantly attracted even if I had known about it. Anyway, they used to go down, as they described it, regularly mob-handed down to the Pillis or the Hip. Well, you can well imagine that the entertainment at the Hip was not of the choicest, because most of the best entertainers were already at the war anyway, so you didn't have much of a choice. Anyway, as the boys said, it was a bit of a lark. So it only cost you about threepence or fourpence to get in, so about 8 of us went off down there, as the boys said, mob-handed. She'd already booked our seats for us. She said, "Oh, I've got the seats for you, darlings." So once she'd got us safely into the best seats she could find for us, or had kept for us, then Joe's next ploy was to say, "All right, Flosh, you know what I do?" And he turned to us, "Who wants chips?" And after a show of hands, Floss disappeared to go and find X bags of fish and chips. Well, I don't remember very much about the show once it started. I simply remembered that I nearly wet my rompers, not so much at what went on the stage, which to some extent was rather boring, but it was what came up from the audience. The British troops really let go their sense of humour. And of all the boring acts of the evening, and yet the most amusing in retrospect, was a very pretentiously named act called something like Miss Gladys and Her Lions. Miss Gladys had two lions, and we only saw one of them at first, and he ambled onto the stage. He was too tired to get there, really, and he was gritting his rubber teeth as he walked, absolutely bored stiff, to the opposite side of the stage, which had a backdrop, a flat painted backdrop of the jungle. and he sat down in front of this and started to lick himself. Well, you don't do that without incurring a certain challenge amongst the British troops to try and get him to do something, because he did seem much too tired to go to bed. So they started throwing things at him, but it didn't move him at all. It hit him all over the rump and so on. But he didn't bother about this. And eventually, however, Miss Gladys took a hand and got him to get on his feet, walk across the stage, amble through a hoop of some kind, and turn round, and he walked back to his corner and sat down while she got on with something with the other lion. So there was old Wallace again, sitting in his corner, licking himself and having bits of impedimenta hitting him all over the body, but still not showing the slightest anger about it. And just as we thought that Wallace was a lost cause, suddenly he got up, inspired, walked over to the flat backdrop of the painted jungle, and weed all over it, which not only brought the house down, but it ruined the frangipani painted thereon. As I say, this was one of the funniest evenings I'd ever spent. It was, in fact, the British services at their best. Another advantage in Aldershot was that I was able to regain acquaintance with the noble game of cricket. There are several splendid sports grounds around there. We were out at Farnborough for this game, which was either against another company or another battalion. I can't remember which, but anyway, I managed to get myself a game. It was one of those games when you would have supposed that our side, after the end of the first innings, had made the great mistake of playing somebody else greatly beyond their class. In fact, however, we won it in the second innings thanks to a magnificent marathon of an innings by a kind of Trevor Bailey who played for us, who absolutely was undefeated right the way through, and we scraped home very narrowly right at the end. I'd never been looked upon as a cricketer because I'd never had an opportunity of demonstrating that I'd handled a bat before. But nevertheless, on that first innings, I was put in as a sort of unknown quantity around about number 8, might be able to bat sort of thing. And after a number of noughts, threes, fives, sevens and so on, which didn't leave as many in the bag, I managed to make 31 not out quite quickly. So the fact that we were all out for about 64, but I'd made quite a few of them. I didn't come off so well in the second innings, but then I didn't need to because this other chap did so well. Anyway, it was a beautiful and memorable day, and as ever on the occasion of cricket matches and similar kinds of manifestations, the army did the thing absolutely perfectly. You would never have thought it was wartime. I don't suppose we actually had strawberries and cream, Wimbledon or Ascot style, but it certainly seemed as if we did, because they absolutely laid everything on with perfect dignity. And as I say, our victory was entirely due to the superb batting of this chap, Keith Slatford. So there we were, in a way, living something of a fool's paradise existence. June 1944 was coming up, but we didn't know that that was going to be the magic month. We didn't know what we were going to be asked to do, the size of it. For all we knew, we were going to sail straight into the Kiel Canal. We simply hadn't got the first idea. Only in retrospect do we know how things panned out. That there was to be a D-Day on June the 6th, and that the landing would be in Normandy. But alongside this, of course, if you haven't the vision to see what's going to happen, you haven't the vision either to be afraid of it. So we took everything in our stride. Each day as it came, we tried to enjoy, and the devil could look after the future. And so it came about that from sometime in May, we began to prepare for a big athletics encounter. We began at company level. We had company athletics, and from that we had a selection of intercompany athletics events, And then we began to take on other battalions in the brigade and finally into the division athletics. Now, these athletics were an interesting piece of planning because as the crescendo developed from, first of all, into platoon, then company, then battalion, and then finally up to the division, it so happened that the divisional sports themselves happened to coincide with June the 6th, D-Day. Well, this becomes relevant later on, but for the moment, let me say that in distance running, our battalion was supreme in the brigade at any rate. There were about four of us who could always clean up at any distance between 1 mile and 6 miles or more. And it was just a question of bookies' choice on the day which of us would win a race within the battalion, and any one of us had a sporting chance of winning it out of the battalion. So we had high promise at that level. And my mentioning the bookies was not accidental. There really were always bookies on hand who studied your form and gave odds on you on the day. On occasions I was the favourite myself and let the punters down. Sometimes I came home. And it's fascinating to recall that quite possibly we were the object of these bookies, these amateur bookies, who would watch us very, very carefully and see whether we ever sneezed. So altogether we had about a fortnight of these athletic meetings, culminating in the 6th of June, the divisional sports. And it so happened on that day that I was on some kind of early morning fatigue. I know I had to get up early and go off and do something or other, with the result that I was the first person to learn from the radio that landings had actually taken place. And I won't pretend that it didn't turn my stomach over, but I was quite agog to get back to the barrack room and tell the rest of the chaps, because there's some sort of comfort in that. In fact, of course, there'd been a lot of aircraft activity the previous evening. It had been really quite noisy, but this was by no means unusual because 1,000-bomber raids over Germany at that time were quite common. However, what we didn't know and couldn't have told even if we looked upwards was that a large number of these planes were carrying parachutists and others were towing gliders for the airborne invasion, the 6th Airborne Division and others. So I made my way back to the hut and woke everybody up and told them, and they promptly threw boots at me and told me to bugger off. And I said, well, no, wait a minute, this is serious. And so I turned the radio on, and of course the radio was full of it, and they immediately sat bolt upright in their beds and more or less in union said, Christ. So they sat there with their ears flapping until somebody suddenly said, well, what about the athletics? So somebody else said, we won't have that, that's for sure. But he was quite wrong. I mean, you just don't stop an athletics meeting because there happens to be an invasion on. And amazingly, we went ahead with it. There was no reason not to. We hadn't had any orders. We didn't know what part we were in. And so we weren't on the move. And so although we still knew that we were for it sooner or later, within the next couple of days, we'd nothing in hand yet but to tool off to the sports ground and run our little hearts out. And incongruous as it may seem, there we were running along in our shorts down there on the ground, while overhead still there were aircraft towing troops in gliders and carrying still parachutists to land in Normandy. So with the stands at this football ground full of supporters, we got on with the job in hand, while the gliders went over the top. For once, our battalion came out as well as it was expected to do, and in the distance, we were absolutely supreme. But I do remember running in, I don't know whether I was second or third, I don't think I was first, but anyway, running in on the straight in the 3 miles, the RSM, old Harry Edwards, who knew me by name, was yelling out, go on bloody Gillick, go on bloody Gillick, go on bloody Gillick, run! I think the meeting probably took a couple of days, this athletics, but certainly by the end of the following day, June the 7th, we were already beginning to pack up and be on the move. We knew what we had to do. We had, in fact, over several weeks, been waterproofing the carriers, and we'd been well-schooled in knowing what we had to pack up and where it had to be put. All vehicles had to be waterproofed against the sea landing, and in the case of the Bren Gun carriers, the procedure was this way. First, you built up the sides of the carrier with metal plates about 3 feet high. The plates were put on all the way round so that instead of having a shape like a trailer that you pull behind a car, the carrier began to look cube-shaped. And the plates, the extension plates, which by the way of course were not armoured like the bottom part of it was, they were welded together with a Bostik waterproofing preparation at the corners. Bearing in mind, of course, that the intention of this was to keep the water out when you went down into the water when you were landing, it followed that you had to lift up the exhaust pipe above the level of the waves. So we had a kind of snake-like metal framed rubber tubing that ran from the exhaust pipe right up to the top of the new waterproofing metal plates. Once we landed, of course, all this would be knocked off and we should be back to our normal fighting rig. Otherwise, on the carrier, of course, we packed everything that we possibly could. There were certain things we weren't allowed to take, but we had to draw ammunition and get onto a complete war footing, camouflage, nets, and absolutely everything, not to mention our personal gear. So together with rations, emergency rations, the object of the exercise was to have enough on board to be able to fight the first battle on landing and survive it. Of course, a lot of the stores you never saw in normal barrack life or home service life, this live ammunition, grenades and so on, we hardly ever saw, and we were never so lethal in our lives, certainly not in the UK. In fact, it was somewhat disappointing that we weren't going to drive with this lot through to London docks. It went separately. The drivers stayed behind and took them by themselves, or they might have gone part of the way on the train, but anyway, we had to go up in lorries. And when I say up, up eventually proved to be Tilbury Docks. This trip was a very moving experience indeed. Of course, we were not alone. There were hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of vehicles making for the docks. The whole of the south of England had been a fortress for quite a long time, and all the chaps had been gathered together, not just in Aldershot, but all over the southern part of England, and waiting for this day, and they all converged upon the docks at the same time, and it affected the civilian population very deeply. We were not only British, but Americans and Canadians and Free French and Poles, everybody heading for the ports. And I suppose we must have set off on this adventure on either June the 8th or the 9th. So the general idea, so far as we were concerned, was that the 11th Armoured Division would work in concert with the 15th Scottish Infantry Division. And whichever division managed to make a hole in the enemy line, then the other one would go through it and fan out. If they punched a hole first, we would go through it and take over. Next stop, Paris, and the one after that, Berlin. Mark you, it didn't work out that way. On the other hand, if we punched the hole first, they would come through and consolidate so that we regrouped to go on yet again. But that was all in the future, and for the moment, the brunt of the fighting was being done by the initial landing divisions who were trying to get inland from the beaches. But there we were for the time being heading towards the docks, we knew not whence, but in fact it proved to be Tilbury. And meanwhile, it rained. And it rained, and it rained, and it rained. But no amount of rain could exceed the torrent of tears from the women who came to their front doors to wave their handkerchiefs at us in this emotional send-off. After all, they'd had years when their loved ones had been abroad at sea, in the air, and at long last it did look as if we were all going over there to finish it off, and they might see their husbands, sons, brothers back quite soon. Back from Italy, back from Africa, back from the Far East and other parts of Asia. Meanwhile, while they wept, the troops sang. Every lorry, of course, sang a different song, but the streets re-echoed to these shouting songs. I suppose it was whistling in the dark, rather. People do this. The nearer death you get, the more you whistle in the dark, and so far as the troops were concerned, they might well have been going to a party in a brewery rather than a war. Anyway, the whole thing was an extremely moving experience. And it really was, so far as I suppose both the civilians and the soldiers were concerned, it was really the climax of a long, hard war, and we were going over the top, literally. Well, now, believe it or not, when we got to Tilbury Docks, there'd been a dock strike on June the 5th and 6th. And even while we were there, their mobile canteen came round, and quite suddenly there was a shout of "Mobile!" and everybody downed tools, and while they were swinging carriers and boxes of ammunition and bits and bobs of tanks and guns on the cranes onto the ships, well, suddenly they dropped everything and rushed off for their tea and wads, leaving these vehicles swaying in the breeze. We couldn't believe our eyes. Well, naturally we couldn't, because we took this all rather seriously. We didn't fancy our chances of getting to the other side of the channel without our weapons and our vehicles and armaments and ammunition and everything. The idea was abhorrent to us. So we took it very seriously indeed that they should be walking out on the job and not applying themselves with the kind of diligence and expedition that we thought they should. It's all a matter of point of view. What was an invaluable half hour off for a cup of tea to them was life and death for us. Anyway, we certainly were on the job all that day, and looking at the dates, it appears that we didn't actually land until the 13th. So we may have had, well, we certainly had two filthy wet nights under canvas at Tilbury. We might even have had a third. But finally, after what may have been about 36 hours in the thick mud, our turn in the queue came, and we got aboard and eventually set off down the Thames in two ships. And as we went, the weather improved. I can't remember the names of the two ships now, but they were probably the so-called Empire ships. An Empire ship, Empire Ouse, Empire Thames, Empire Severn, Empire Waverley, all named after rivers. And these ships were previously German merchant ships which had been captured and converted to our use. So it was probably in a couple of those that we travelled. And we hadn't gone very far down the Thames before we saw two huge cotton reels, they looked like cotton reels, floating in the river, and there were people working on them, and they did look like cotton reels, and instead of cotton they seemed to have huge pipes wound round and round and round, very much indeed as you might wind a hose onto a cylindrical carrier in the garden. And it was only later that we discovered that these were actually Pluto, P-L-U-T-O, the pipeline under the ocean, which was to carry fuel so economically from Britain across the water to keep us supplied. We eventually arrived off Southend, and there I suppose the convoy gathered in the estuary, and it meant that we stayed there overnight. We slept on board, anchored off Southend during that night. I suppose we were on the ships two nights, at any rate, before we finally landed. But there was rather an amusing episode off Southend that following morning. There was a group of us, perhaps Arthur Vodden, Norman Cuff, and one or two others, leaning against the rail, generally surveying the sea and our prospects, when, quite incredibly, it looked as if there was a shoal of fish heading straight for our ship. And we couldn't understand what this was until one of the more knowing among us identified it as, in fact, a shoal of contraceptives. Apparently they'd opened the sewers that morning, and out they'd come heading straight for the fleet. Needless to say, there was a whoop of approval from the troops and three hearty cheers for fun and games. Not unmixed, I suppose, with a certain amount of envy. A very interesting feature of the voyage was the fact that by this time we'd been paid out in what they called invasion francs. The idea of it was that these should be valid once we landed in France, because we wouldn't have any native French francs, but they were supposed to be fully valid in any village that we took. The pub owners or estaminet or shopkeepers must accept this as valid. It would be honoured later on by the Allied governments. But of course, it looked like monopoly money, and it was extremely difficult for us, the troops, to take it seriously. And of course, this money made a particular appeal to those with a gambling instinct, and to those who didn't think they would survive the war anyway. So there they were, everywhere you went, these little knots of chaps sitting around and gambling with this monopoly money, and they were gambling absolutely horrendous sums. When you think about it, £20 in those days was a vast sum of money. It was considerably more than anybody would get in a fortnight as an ordinary soldier. And they were gambling £20 on the turn of a single card. Well, I'm afraid it wasn't for me. I have no nerve for gambling, and I don't like cards very much anyhow, but these fellows had this sort of sense of resignation, I suppose, and they were prepared to do it. Furthermore, they reasoned they hadn't spent very much money during the past week. They couldn't spend money so long as they were on board, and what money they might be able to spend in France was questionable anyway. They might be killed on the beach for all they knew. As a matter of fact, later on it was discovered that in certain spots the French didn't trust this monopoly money any more than we did. Anyway, eventually we pulled out into the channel in absolutely perfect weather, and the whole convoy began to move down the channel, and we were able to sit up sunbathing on the deck in our skins. We were also able to enjoy the wonderful spectacle of the way in which the Navy looked after us, in a way that the Navy alone can. The destroyers weaved in and out between the ships, and occasionally the captain of the destroyer would have a quiet word with the captain of our ship, but always talking as if he was talking across a table rather than across the sea. He had a loud hailer, and it came over beautifully, and the kind of message would go something like this: "Captain, as you know, we're on amber alert at the moment. There have been reports of enemy aircraft, but very much further up the channel, more towards the Hook of Holland. If anything serious develops, I shall give you ample warning. Then we will take dispersal stations as we've arranged. Thank you." It was easy and quiet and as intimate as all that. I can't express the admiration that I had for the way in which the Navy handled it. And of course we weren't alone. The sea was absolutely full of ships. It was a magnificent spectacle. And there were ships as far as the eye could see, obviously stretching all the way round to the Normandy coast. And all the time there were the destroyers bobbing and weaving in between us, pushing us around and giving us messages, generally hustling us along like a mother duck with a lot of chicks. So up to this point it was a pleasure cruise. The only apparent restriction upon our movements was the fact that we weren't allowed to be up on the top decks, the upper decks. We had to stay down on the lower deck so that we could be organized and take cover if there was an air raid. When we'd first got on board, we'd been assigned to various holds for sleeping, and each hold was slung with hammocks, dozens of them. And of course, soldiers are not very used to sleeping in hammocks. So that was something we had to get used to. Meanwhile, in the particular hold where we were, and near the hammock where I was to sleep, there was the most frightful smell. I didn't know what it was. And when somebody came round, we said, look, I don't want to seem as if we're complaining, but can anything be done about this smell? And they said, yeah, it does smell rather foul, doesn't it? What is it? I said, I have really no idea. I'm wondering if you could trace it. And they did trace it. It was a dead rat. And they got rid of it and cleaned the place up a bit. So that was all right. Anyway, that night we were going to sleep in the hammocks, and we expected to land in Normandy the following day. Needless to say, we'd been very carefully briefed about U-boat and air raid emergency stations, and we knew exactly what to do if there was an alert. Meanwhile, we slept in our hammocks, fully dressed, boots on and all. And that's the end of side one of tape one of the autobiography, June 1944.